The COP26 summit in Glasgow revealed huge global divides on tackling climate change. Scientists say the pledges to cut emissions and preserve our planet don't go far enough. So, what's been achieved? This is Inside Story. Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Mohammed Jamjoum. The UN COP26 summit in Glasgow was called our last chance to combat the climate crisis. Representatives from nearly 200 countries spent the past 2 weeks debating how to limit global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius from pre-industrial levels. Negotiations went past Friday's deadline. Delegates disagreed on the wording of the final agreement. Contentious issues include phasing out fossil fuel subsidies and funding for developing nations to adapt. Tuvalu's foreign minister even delivered an address knee-deep in seawater to show how low-lying Pacific Island nations are sinking as sea levels rise. We'll bring in our guests in a moment. First, here's what the president of COP26 had to say.
This is our collective moment in history. This is our chance to forge a cleaner, healthier, more prosperous world. And this is our time to deliver on the high ambition set by our leaders at the start of this summit. We must rise to the occasion.
Andrew Simmons has this report from Glasgow.
COP26 has really been a summit of two halves. The first week had some really ambitious projects. Coalitions of the willing came forward, with 100 countries pledging to cut 30% of highly toxic methane emissions by 2030. There was an agreement on deforestation, cutting it right back by the same time period, 2030, the deadline. More than 40 countries committed to shifting away from fossil fuels, some very new countries in there. Now, these were projects outside of COP26, outside of the Paris Agreement, and they really did serve to give a lot of hope for the proceedings. Nevertheless, at the weekend, we saw demonstrations right the way across the world, tens of thousands massing in the streets of Glasgow on Saturday, making the point that really COP26 was going nowhere based on what it had achieved so far in terms of the Paris Agreement, in terms of tackling emissions. And emissions have been the center point of proceedings in week two. One of the problems had been the wide variation in commitments countries were prepared to make to emissions and the frequency of declaring their goals. That had really caused a lot of angst throughout the second week. That, coupled with really targeting the issue of fossil fuel and whether or not to push that harder and harder, that does appear to have been the case. And so really you have now a situation where political will has been the primary point at the end of the day on where things get decided on and where we go from here. Andrew Simmons for Inside Story.
Here are some of the pledges made during the past 2 weeks. China and the United States have announced they'll work together to keep temperature rises below 1.5 degrees Celsius. But the world's two biggest polluters have not given further details. More than 100 nations agreed to cut methane emissions by 30%. But countries with major agricultural industries such as Australia and China didn't sign up. They also failed to join a commitment by 40 countries to phase out coal power. India promised to cut emissions to net zero by 2070, 20 years later than the summit's goal. A $10.5 billion fund was launched to help developing nations transition to renewable energy. And 110 leaders pledged to end deforestation by 2030. Signatories include Brazil, where illegal logging of the Amazon rainforest is rising. All right, let's bring in our guests in Glasgow. Michael Jacobs, an environmental economist and professor at the University of Sheffield in the UK. From Malé in the Maldives, Ibrahim Mohammed, Deputy Director General of the Environmental Protection Agency of the Maldives. And in New Delhi, Arjun Dutt, Program Leader at the Council on Energy, Environment and Water. A warm welcome to you all, and thanks so much for joining us today. on Inside Story. Michael, let me start with you today. You were there in Glasgow at the summit. After 2 weeks of speeches and negotiations and dire warnings and sounding the alarms, would you consider COP26 to be a success or a failure?
I think it depends how you measure it. If you judge it by what's happening in the world on climate change, where emissions are still rising, we're meant to be on a path to cutting emissions by 45% by 2030 if we're to hold global temperature rise to 1.5 degrees, as was agreed in Paris, in the Paris Climate Agreement in 2015. We're on course currently for to raise emissions by about 16% in 2030. If you look at the devastating climate impacts that we're seeing all over the world, but particularly in the poorest countries, they are not going to be changed by what was decided here. So if you look at the real world, I don't think there was any chance of COP26 being a success because we are not we need to change course, and we haven't done that here. But if you judge COP26 by what could have been achieved, what an international climate change negotiation can achieve, then I think it's been a moderate success. The one big issue that we had to face here was to acknowledge that the emissions cuts, which countries have pledged, are not good enough. They don't add up to a pathway which will limit global warming to 1.5 degrees. So countries have acknowledged that here, and they've said we're going to come back next year with stronger commitments. So in a sense, the big decision has been put off by a year, but this COP was never going to do anything better than that, and it has done that. So in that sense, I think it has been a qualified success given the limited ambitions that any COP could have had. And there is going to be more money for the most vulnerable countries, the poorest countries, so that too is a good thing.
Arjun, Michael says he believes that it's a qualified success. I saw you nodding along to a lot of what he was saying, so I want to give you the chance to jump in because it looks like you wanted to. And I also want to ask you, from your perspective, from your perch there in New Delhi, what do you think has been achieved?
Thank you. Well, from my perspective, COP26, they were billing it as make or break from the perspective of limiting global temperature rise to 1.5 degrees. If you measure it from that barometer, it has certainly not succeeded. I mean, there have been certain incremental progress made in areas such as finalization or working towards finalizing the implementation guidelines for carbon markets under Article 6. There have been enhanced decarbonization ambitions voiced by some developing countries. There has also been greater ambition in terms of commitments towards phasing out coal. But there has been progress on a number of very important areas, actually has simply not been enough. So Michael talked about climate finance. Actually, the progress made on climate finance is not sufficient to allow developing countries to decarbonize fast enough. And advanced or developed countries also miss the opportunity to enhance their decarbonization ambitions, both long-term as well as near-term, to align their trajectories with the 1.5 degree world. Mm-hmm. So I would say that there has been some progress made, but overall, it is not a success.
Michael, Arjun was just talking about the issue of financing. Of course, there have been a lot of pledges of financial aid. Those are all fine and good. They have been praised. But what I'm curious about is money actually getting from richer nations to developing countries fast enough.
And you have raised exactly the same point there that many of the developing country delegates have been raising here, particularly the poorest countries and the ones that are suffering the most from climate change. If you look at the money that has so far been dispersed from richer countries to poorer ones, which at present, as far as we know, up to 2019, only amounts to about $80 billion a year, which is less than the $100 billion a year that was meant to be provided by 2020. Most of that has gone into not the poorest countries, and it's not gone into adaptation, that is, coping with the climate change that countries are already experiencing. Most of it has gone into mitigation, that is, reducing emissions in areas like renewable energy. And that's good. Those are helping to cut global emissions. But a lot of that is for loans, so it's not really a gift. And it is going to countries which have stronger financial systems of their own, where the richer countries feel more confident that the money will be invested, and of course will make them a return if those are loans. And what the poorest and most vulnerable countries have wanted is grant money So that's simple grants for adaptation, for coping with climate change. And that has always been the correlation, if you like, of climate finance. Only about a quarter of climate finance has gone to the poorer countries for adaptation. They wanted it doubled to half, at least. They would have liked more than that. And one of the good things about this agreement is that it does commit the developed world to providing around half, a doubling of current rates to go towards adaptation. Now, that needs to be in the form of grants, and that's not yet been specified. And many of the poorest countries say, you know, we're penalised because many of the most vulnerable countries say we're penalised because we're experiencing major effects from climate change, but we're not poor enough to qualify for some kinds of aid. So there's still a lot of questions about the delivery of this money, and a lot of questions about exactly where it's gone. Developed countries are not very good at accounting for it. So a lot of work still to do, but some progress made, I think. I'm sure your guests from developing countries will have their own views on this too.
Arjun, let me ask you about that. How big is the gap between what is needed by developing countries and what has been provided by rich countries?
Right. So in terms of the scale of finance that would be needed, so let's say the reported figures, like Michael pointed out, are around 80 billion. And I'll stress reported, and I'll get to that in a moment. But in terms of what is needed, the scale of finance is more along the lines of 1 trillion annually, is what would be needed to actually set the world on a decarbonization pathway towards 1.5 degrees. And I want to stress that the current flows, as Michael pointed out, that there have been some criticisms on the actual accounting of these flows. So developing countries have stated that a large chunk of the reported flows are actually just commitments and not actual flows. Some of the reported figures they say do not represent new and additional flows. And as Michael correctly pointed out, the share of grant capital is actually quite low. So while we need higher scale of flows that will flow into commercially viable investment opportunities where money is already flowing, but where more is needed, we need more grant capital to enable money to flow into investment opportunities where it is not currently flowing. So these include nascent technologies that do not have an established business models or a technology performance track record, such as off-grid renewables, such as maybe storage, and also the vast majority of adaptation activities where clear business case does not exist. And as Michael clearly also pointed out, that underdeveloped countries where investment risks are high also need grant capital, either in the form of direct grants, or a more smart way of channeling this capital is through catalytic de-risking of investment opportunities that would then allow far greater quantities of private sector capital to flow and plug the gap between existing flows and those desired for sustainable pathways.
Ibrahim, what do island nations like the Maldives need in order to stop the effects of climate change?
Well, I guess the loss and damage talk is very important for us as well. If we look at Maldives, we have spent over the past 5 years more than 100 million for coastal protection alone. Let alone providing safe drinking water. We are spending a lot of money. And a lot of this is because we need to adapt to the increase in impacts of climate change. And also a lot of small island nations have huge debts owed to various donor organizations as well as donor countries as well. We have huge debts owed to some countries which have been giving us loans for various kinds of projects. Many of these projects are also adaptation related because coastal protection as well as some investments for mitigation such as solar energy. These projects also, we have got financial backing in the form of loans as debt money as well. So we have to also think about this issue as well. Our GDP, if 30 or 40% of our GDP is to be paid for loans and debts, mm-hmm. we will no longer have the capacity for adaptation projects as well. So we really need this.
Michael, there's been a lot of focus at COP26 on the role of fossil fuels. What do you think about this discussion that's been had over the last 2 weeks? It's been given much more focus than in previous COP summits, correct?
Well, it's the very first time that a COP has actually mentioned fossil fuels in a final text at all. You might think that rather remarkable, given that fossil fuels are the major cause of climate change. But the fossil fuel sectors and the countries in which they're located have always resisted any language about fossil fuels. This text does one very good thing in that sense. It says we need to accelerate the phase out of coal. Coal is the most polluting in carbon terms and also in local air pollution terms of all the fossil fuels. And we're not going to deal with this problem if coal continues as the energy source of choice of countries around the world. That's difficult because many countries are dependent on coal, but this text acknowledges that we have to phase out coal much more quickly than we're currently doing now. So that's good, but there's no mention of oil and gas. As various people have pointed out, there are a lot of oil and gas sector companies at the COP trying to lobby countries here, and they have succeeded in keeping any mention of oil and gas out of the text. There were countries like Saudi Arabia that really didn't want them mentioned. And we have a really very weaselly form of words on fossil fuel subsidies that the text calls for fossil fuel subsidies to be phased out, but only inefficient fossil fuel subsidies. There are, of course, no efficient fossil fuel subsidies. Subsidies to fossil fuels is paying the polluter. And the principle that we had all agreed was that the polluter should pay. So none of them are really inefficient. None of them are really efficient. But strangely, countries always claim that their fossil fuel subsidies are efficient. And they've always used that word as a get out from doing anything. So the language on coal is good and significant because it's a first. Elsewhere, the text really hasn't dealt with that issue. But of course, if countries do have to phase out, do have to improve their emissions reduction commitments over the next 10 years, as they have committed to do, that will involve, in practice, a phasing down of fossil fuels. So it will happen whether or not there's a specific mention of it in this text.
Ibrahim, I just want to take a step back for a moment and look at the effects of climate change, because the Maldives, of course, you know, you're dealing with the ramifications of climate change more than most countries in the world. Climate change has meant that the Maldives is fighting for its very survival. So without a drastic cut in emissions, just how dire could things get there?
Well, as you know, 1.5 degrees itself is also quite dire, quite looming threat, because the Maldives is an entirely coral reef-based country. And corals are getting damaged and bleached continuously. Over the past two decades, we have seen more warming. And so the Maldives will be facing huge consequences if it tips beyond 1.5 degrees. At this moment also, we are facing a lot of damage, a lot of coastal erosion. About 90% of our inhabited islands are faced with coastal erosion. And coastal engineering infrastructures to protect the coastal erosion from coastal erosion is quite huge expense, which will be in billions of dollars if we are to fortify all the 186 or so islands inhabited by people. So we are facing this, and also very important aspect is the increase in storm activity in the Indian Ocean. As the experts have said, the Indian Ocean is warming more rapidly than in the past decades. And so the storm activities in the Indian Ocean has increased. And the Maldives is now getting the impacts from these storms, which actually have more devastating effects on India and Sri Lanka and Bangladesh. But we are also facing the impacts of these as well. So 1.5 is the bare minimum that we need to survive, and beyond that will be quite devastating for small island nations like ours.
Arjun, one of the biggest surprises to come out in the last couple of weeks was this agreement. China and the U.S. agreed to boost climate cooperation over the next two decades. That's something that took a lot of people by surprise. These joint steps that were agreed to by the world's two biggest carbon emitters to limit global temperature rise, are they going to be enough to really make a difference?
It's a start. It's certainly encouraging. But, you know, as Ibrahim was pointing out, that even 1.5 degree could result in dire consequences. The other thing to be, you know, really mindful of in the climate change debate is the principle of equity and climate justice, where, of course, certain countries, such as the developed countries like the United States, but also China, in terms of its historical as well as projected emissions, are expected to corner the majority of the carbon space, leaving very little for developing countries. So while agreements between the US and China are a good start, what is needed is enhanced ambition from the major emitters. So essentially, for climate justice, we need developed countries and regions like the EU and the US to advance their net zero years, and also large emitters like China, which will, of course, are expected to or projected to corner the maximum carbon space, if you take into account both historical and future projections, should then also further advance their net zero years to give countries like the Maldives and other developing countries the room to meet their developmental needs, and then also steer their economies towards net zero in a time frame that helps them balance these priorities. So in summary, we'd like the developed countries to advance to achieve net zero first, countries like China, which are of course also very large emitters, to achieve net zero next, and other developing countries to then achieve net zero based on their respective circumstances. And if I might just add a quick point to, you know, what Michael mentioned, what the draft text also, you know, interestingly mentions a just transition in addition to phasing out coal. So a portion of the climate finance that we talked about should also be, directed towards achieving a just transition in tandem with the phasing out of coal.
Ibrahim, where do we go beyond just political action at this point? What needs to be done from a business, community, and individual level in order to really limit climate change?
Well, at local level, in our countries as well, you know, democracy, transparency, human rights, these are also critical issues. I believe not all developing nations or small island nations have the social justice and equity part at local level very highly integrated in their policies, planning, and strategies. And also the transparency with regard to the climate finance, this needs to be boosted. When the projects are being implemented, the local communities need to be engaged more. And also with regard to awareness and education, not just at school level, but at community level, we need to boost it as well.
Arjun, we only have about a minute and a half left. Let me just ask you, do you at this point have a sense of hope that enough goodwill will come out of this summit and that it will actually lead to change?
While COP26 at Glasgow at least gave us glimpses of hope in terms of the acknowledgement of the current deficiencies in the delivery of climate finance, in the inadequacies of current ambitions with regard to decarbonization, that is the first step. But more needs to be done, regardless of hope, it just needs to be done, and that is the most important thing.
Michael, the fact that so many youth activists and protesters have been coming out, does that suggest to you that things could change even if political leaders don't do enough going forward?
I think that is the source of hope, to be perfectly honest. We've spent a quarter of a century not doing enough on climate change. The first scientist report in the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, was in 1990. We've known this issue was upon us, and we haven't done enough. And it is the young people of today who are angry about that. They're angry at my generation for not acting enough. And they are the voters of tomorrow. So I think it's been very, very significant that we've seen so many young people expressing that anger. We've seen new spokespeople emerge, not just Greta Thunberg, but other young people, particularly from the global south. And I think politicians will now be under incredible pressure from their young people to take the further ambitious acts that Arjun has talked about. And I think that is one of the most hopeful things to come out of this COP.
All right. Well, we have run out of time, so we're going to have to leave the conversation there. Thanks so much to all of our guests, Michael Jacobs, Ibrahim Mohammed, and Arjun Dutt. And thank you, too, for watching. You can see the program again anytime by visiting our website, aljazeera.com. And for further discussion, go to our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/AJInsideStory. You can also join the conversation on Twitter. Our handle is @AJInsideStory. For me, Mohammed Jamjoum, and the whole team here, bye for now.